Now, for the third 45 on Gaiety, I understand the Blue Cats came back again to the studio, but this time they had become the Sonics.
Right. They had changed their name, same group, basically, and I'm not sure why they changed their name, but they did Marlene and Minus One Blast Off, and both the Sonic and the Blue Cat record, if I recall, are some of the most desirable collectible records that people want.
Now, this 45 was also done at Shelly Products?
I don't recall if it was done at Shelly or if it was done at K-Bank.
So your studio now is starting to grow in popularity. Are you attracting more and more business with these as each new 45 comes out?
I was getting a number of St. Paul groups. I don't remember the name of them all, but the two I do remember, which were very, very good, was the Wisdoms and the Valquins, both from Central High School in St. Paul. And had I had connections with Motown when they were starting at that point in time, I would have loved to license their material to the company. In fact, at that point in time in my recording career, I was doing a great deal of licensing. I found that this was very easy, and record companies, as they existed, were always looking for new talent. I had done work for Sid Fry at Audio Fidelity. I'd done the Golden Garter group, which was a banjo group, and also done the Robbinsdale Chorale. I had met with Johnny Paleo, the Dukes of Dixieland, had done a lot of things for Sid Fry. So it was interesting. At that point in time, it was very easy to license music to companies.
Now, I understand in sometime around 1959, you purchased a Neumann lathe. What's the story on that?
At that time, Neumann had just brought in two lathes from Germany. And Neumann was actually a company was Gotham Audio. Gotham Audio had the rights to Neumann. Telefunken, just a little background, Telefunken was basically a distributor of Neumann, Sennheiser, Schlapp's microphones. When Neumann brought microphones in this country under the Neumann name, Telefunken could no longer get Neumann microphones. That's when they switched to having AKG make the Telefunken 251. Just a little history here. The thing was, he was bringing in two lathes, an automatic lathe called the VMS-66 and a manual lathe called the AM-131. I was interested in the AM-131. It was $2,850 at the time, which was about the same price as a Presto 8DG. But the Neumann had a lot better features than the Presto lathe at the time, and the Scully lathe, which was the other lathe manufacturer, was far too expensive. So I had gotten the Neumann AM-131. Steve Timmer, the owner of Gotham Audio, had come in when it came in and actually helped me set it up. And we put the Gotham Grampian head on it, and it came with a variable, not variable pitch, but a single lead screw that you, by changing gears, you could change the pitch or the lines per inch. So for a 28-minute LP, you could use a lead screw that did 280 lines per inch. For a 15-minute one, you would use one that did 150 lines per inch. So it was a very versatile lathe that had a vacuum hold down, which held the disc. Instead of screwing it to the turntable, it held it by vacuum. So it was a very, very advanced machine. I did a lot of mastering on it. Some of the groups I mastered on it were the String Kings. I did the Valquins. I did the Wisdoms on it. I did the Flames. I did Chuck Carson, Tommy D, the Corvettes, Galaxies, Howie Butler. A lot of these people, a lot of these groups came from out of town and so forth. And it was a lot of fun back then.
Where did you buy the lathe from?
That was, again, through Lou Bonn, Hi-Fi Sound, because they were the distributor for Gotham Audio.
So I'm thinking $2,850 in 1959, wouldn't that have been roughly the same price as a very, very fancy new car?
No, actually, it was more than a car. I remember having a 1960 Mercury. That was like a convertible. That was $1,800, which I had gotten in an accident with and ended up with a 1960 Pontiac convertible, which was $2,200. And that was their most expensive Pontiac Bonneville at the time.
Did you have enough money to purchase the machine, or did you have to take out a loan?
I had enough money because I was doing a lot of recording and making very good profit then. And plus, I had a job at United Hardware.
In 1959, I understand you stopped by K-Bank recording one day, and you just happened to be there when an artist from up in the Fargo area was recording a song called Susie Baby. The artist, of course, was Bobby V. What's the story on that?
Well, basically, I just stopped by there, and there he was, a recording, and I sat in on a session, met Bobby, met his group called The Shadows, which, to my understanding, the group didn't have a name until the day of the recording. So the story goes. That's what it might be called, hearsay. But he's a nice kid, and I've stayed in contact with him and his sons, off and on. And as you probably know, Bobby V is, I think, got Parkinson's disease now or something like that.
And, of course, his recording of Susie Baby was released on the local Soma label, and that got him a national contract with the Liberty label and launched his career, and he became one of the top 1960s recording stars from the Midwest.
Well, a little bit of history on that. Soma was owned by Amos Heilzer. Everybody that recorded at K-Bank that wanted to be on the Soma label and paid the $4.95 or whatever they charged became a Soma artist. Susie Baby, if you recall, sounded a lot like Buddy Holly. Buddy Holly had died at that time. And Amos Heilitzer, who owned Soma and also was the distributor for Liberty Records, he was a major record distributor, saw the potential there, sent the record to Snuff Garrett, who owned Liberty Records, and that's how history was made.
Did any of the Gaiety 45s get airplay here in the Twin Cities?
Not really. That I know, maybe some of them did, but not to any potential because it was very difficult. Payola still existed, and they weren't playing, like for the Wisdoms and the Valquins, nobody was playing that kind of music back, the doo-wop stuff back then. It was only station playing it, if I recall, was WDGY, Merle Edwards, and I'm not sure he was still in the air back then.
Now, in the 1959 and early 1960 time period, folk music was quite popular. Do you recall the first folk band to visit your basement recording studio?
The first folk group to visit my studio was the Mark IV. There was a group whose mom of the leader worked at KSTP, who I had met one time when I had met Jimmy Valentine. And she was telling me about her son, and I got to meet him, and that was the first folk group that we recorded. And one of the songs that we recorded was called Cotton Fields. And at that time, Cameo Parkway had the Highwaymen, which did Michael Row the Shore. And I thought, boy, maybe they want another folk group. So I sent him an acetate of Cotton Fields and Mark's group. Next thing I know, they rejected the group but took the song, and because it was a public domain song, and it was the second hit for the Highwaymen. So that was interesting. That was Cameo Parkway in Philadelphia that did that. But those things were common back then, so there wasn't anything of let's sue them or anything because the music was public domain and the arrangement was nothing special.
Do we know the last name for Mark?
I don't recall.
Now, two groups that you recorded had live albums that were released on the Audio Fidelity label. What is the story on those two groups?
Well, I had originally known the conductor, John Adams, of the Robbinsdale Choir for a long time because I did a lot of his choir recordings when I did remotes. He had contacted me to do a fundraising record for him called Concert Time 730, which I did, which had the Robbinsdale Chorale, which was the Robbinsdale City Band. The City Band was made up of ex-alumni from the high school choir. Anyway, I had sent that to Sid Fry because I knew he was looking for a choral group, and right away he signed them. And then after I got to know Sid, we did the Levee Loungers, which was a Dixieland band from St. Paul, and Dave Wesley, who's a dentist, or was a dentist, I don't know if he's still even around, but he was the lead for the Levee Loungers. And then I became real good friends with Sid, and as I said earlier, met Johnny Paleo and his harmonica gang, the Dukes of Dixieland, and Sid was like a second father to me. He took me all over and really a very, very nice guy. In fact, I'm still in contact with his daughter. I talk to her maybe once every 2-3 months about old times.
So the Audio Fidelity label was for audiophiles and known for recording esoteric musical groups and for their very high quality recordings and pressings and album covers, correct?
Well, yes, an interesting story there is Sid Fry originally had sent a stereo tape to Westrex to get a sample of them cutting a stereo master. There were two people bidding to make stereo cutting heads. One was Teldec of Germany and the other was Westrex in the USA. Sid then took that disc that Westrex cut, the sample, had it plated and pressed it and released it. It was a disc of the Dukes of Dixieland, and it was the start of what he called the first stereo disc, and nobody could play it, yet it was a stereo disc, and that is how Westrex ended up being the standard, and actually Teldec was a better system than Westrex was. But Sid Fry was a real promoter, and that's how we ended up with the Westrex system as our standard for stereo cutting.
Now, I understand your studio moved locations at one point here. When did this happen, and where did you move to?
Empire Photosound, which was a producer of industrial films, which was on Lindell and Franklin, was interested in a sound engineer, and they had contacted me and asked if I wanted to move my studio and everything to their premises and become their sound engineer. And at that point in time, I left United Hardware and said, well, why not? So we moved the studio to their facilities, and I didn't record that many things there. I moved the lathe there, and it was the first time I was using, instead of tape echo, I was using Hammond organ springs for echo. And I recorded the Yeomen there. That was another folk group.
And what time period are we at now, David?
Right around 1962, if I recall.
Okay, and switching from tape echo to the Hammond organ springs, what was the difference in the sound?
Well, with tape echo, you always got a like da 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 if you gave it too much. With the Hammond organ springs, you also had the fact if you gave it too much, you'd also get a tinny sound, but it seemed to be a better job of echoing. I mean, the other choices was getting an actual chamber, which was a room with a speaker in it, or what they call the EMT metal plate. At that point in time, there were no digital reverbs available.
So the Yeomen recorded an album there, correct?
Yes. And at that point in time, I was involved with Junior Achievement. We started a Junior Achievement record company, which was the first time they ever did anything like that. And the Yeomen was the group that we recorded because the leader of the Yeomen, Keith Critchlow, was the president of our Junior Achievement group, which was all high school kids. And he was from Edina High School, if I recall right. Anyway, what an interesting story. I licensed the recording to Mercury and put it out because they wanted to go on the benefits of Junior Achievement Company helping youth and so forth. So we did that, and the company itself, which was called High Top Recordings, we also did a 45 with another folk group called the West Winds, became the most profitable Junior Achievement Company in the country. And we wanted to do it for a second year, and Junior Achievement refused. They said, you're making too much money. You're not a Junior Achievement Company anymore.
So they said, you're making too much money. You're too successful in order to be a Junior Achievement Company?
Correct.
How did you feel about that?
Well, it wasn't how I felt. I mean, that was really, I mean, Junior Achievement was supposed to be a company to learn business and make some profit because other companies were sponsored by Honeywell, General Mills, so forth. I happened to be the sponsor. Gady Records was the sponsor of this company, and they just said you were taking in, your profits far exceeded what was in the boundaries of Junior Achievement, which at that time was, and probably still is, a nonprofit organization.
Who were the other members of the Yeoman, and who played what?
Jack Otterness on guitar, Keith Critchlow on banjo and vocals, Don Bennett on stand-up bass, and Bob Finkenauer on guitar and vocals. And interesting side note, Bob Finkenauer became the first manager of the whole Southdale complex when that became built.
Do you have any idea how many albums the band sold?
Not really, because at that point in time, if you were to get a record companies weren't that great on giving you an honest count of how many records they sold or manufactured.
How about on the High Top label?
We sold a couple thousand.
Any airplay on that in town here?
Yeah, I think we did have some airplay.
Okay. Do you recall what songs were on the Yeoman 45?
One of them was Carrie Waits for Me, which was written by one of the executives at Mercury Records.
So did the students run High Top Records themselves, like as a regular business?
There was myself and two other college people that were advisors like I was. But the students basically ran it. We set it up as a record company with an A&R department, promotion department, sales department, and so forth. President, vice president, all of that. It was run like a company. We had meetings once a week.
So you had a formal business organization with president, vice president, secretary, treasurer,
yes,
director of promotions, and
right.
And how did the students do?
They loved it. More people wanted to join our company. We had a capacity crowd in our, we had 60 people, which was, most companies had like 20, 25. We had 60 and more wanting to come, but we were well over the limit that we couldn't even handle the 60.
Was this something unusual or unique for a Junior Achievement company to be running a record company?
Yes. In fact, the president, Keith Critchlow, was nominated as president of Junior Achievement nationally for the best student president in the whole country. He was awarded an award in Chicago. So, I mean, we did get a lot of press.
So the other band you mentioned, the West Winds, where were they from?
They were from Robbinsdale High School.
Do we know any of the members?
Bob Simpson, Jerry Roulette, Tom Johnson, and Sheldon Sizer. They were the four members of the West Winds. Bob Simpson passed away about 2 years ago. Shel Sizer, one of the reasons we did the record is he had cancer and died about a month after we had done it. The songs were Cotton Mill Girls, backed by 500 Miles.
So that came out on the High Top label as a 45?
Yes.
And any idea how many of those were sold?
About 1,000.
Okay. Any airplay in the Twin Cities?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. And no album, though, for the West Winds?
No.
Did you try to get them licensed?
No.
So of all the Junior Achievement companies in the country, how did High Top Records fit in as far as making money?
We were the most profitable. There's no question about that.
Nationwide?
Nationwide.
You made the most money.
And the most recognized.
Now, you had a change in studio location again, correct, after the Empire Photo Sound?
Right. If I recall, I moved back home for a short period of time and then went into the Calhoun Beach Club, which was formerly occupied by WTCN. So I used their control room and did recordings there. I wasn't there very long, and then moved to the Builders Exchange Building, which housed WDGY. At the time, it was WDGY's original Top 40 studio, but then it was empty. And in fact, I had recorded there one time for a program. I forget the guy. It was a program on WDGY called Night Watch, where I was the mystery guest. And it was funny because my Hebrew teacher happened to be listening. This was the gentleman that I originally got interested in recording with and called in and identified, oh, I know who he is. And that was funny. So that's a little side note.
Let's talk about two other folk bands that you recorded, the Flint Hill Singers and the Goldbriars. Let's start with the Flint Hill Singers. What's the story on them?
They were students at Washburn High School in South Minneapolis, and at that point in time, they were kind of a copycat of the New Christie Minstrels, which were very, very popular. And they were a 10-piece group. I think I recorded them when they were their 10-piece group originally at the Calhoun Beach Hotel, and basically did them on a two-track, did them on the Ampex recorder, and so forth, and became very interested in them because I thought I might be able to do something with them via licensing. John Haney came into the picture. I worked with him at Empire Photo Sound, and he felt we should reduce the group to six. And at that point in time, my studio was then located at the Lumber Exchange Building in the old WDGY studio.